All right. Well, let's roll. It's 12:01. I'm Dr. Bruce Sadlick here at the Naturopathic Medical Board meeting. And with us today is our executive director, Ms. Gail Anthony, and our attorney, Mr. Hutchinson. And we'll do a roll call.
Okay. Dr. Sadlick?
Here.
Ms. Gallen?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Scott?
Here.
Dr. Rubin and Dr. Popio are both absent today. We do have quorum.
All right. The board does have a civility policy, and I'll read this for you briefly. In accordance with the open meeting law, the board has a civility policy that prohibits any type of disorderly conduct that disrupts the board from carrying out its business. We'll ask you once to modify your behavior, and if you don't, we'll discontinue the call with you. And from this point, we'll move on to 4A. With the board's permission, I'd like to use 4A through S, as in Sam. And I'll make the motion, but I'll need a second on that.
This is Dr. Spratt, I second that.
Okay, you're Dr. Spratt.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries.
Next, what I'd like to do is we'll move on to number 5. This is review, consideration, and possible action regarding the following board cases. I'm going to be taking these a little bit out of order. So I'll start off with 5A will be Sweet. 5B will be Tade. 5C will be Nelson. 5D, as in dog, will be Beardsley. And 5E will be Eastman. And with that being said, let's go ahead and roll on to 5A, which would be Dr. Sweet. Dr. Sweet, are you on the phone line?
None of these have their video.
Mr. Kerr, are you representing Dr. Sweet?
Yes, Chair, I am. Thank you.
Will he be joining us, or will you be?
I believe he's on Chair under William Nelson, but I can't confirm that because I don't have any photograph on it or any video on it. Okay. Dr. Sweet, is that you?
No, this is Dr. William Nelson.
Sorry, Dr. Nelson. Yeah, I don't see him. The board wanted to table or go. I'm present, but if the board wanted to table to be able to talk to Dr. Sweet, I've asked my assistant to reach out to his office to confirm he's able to log on.
Okay. Board members, do we want to table Dr. Sweet, or Mr. Carey, did you want to speak for him, or was he going to speak for himself?
I believe I was going to speak for him, but certainly given the nature of the allegation that it's not related to a standard of care, it's a self-report under your criminal reporting statute, you may want to speak directly to him. And at least that's been my experience with your board, but I certainly will defer to how the board wants to go forward.
Okay.
Dr. Sadlick, excuse me, Dr. Sweet just logged on. Dr. Sweet, are you with us? Dr. Sweet? I do see him on the line.
Yeah, I saw that pop up. Dr. Sweet?
I think the audio is up.
Yeah, he's on mute. I didn't know if you have the ability to unmute him, Gail, because I do see him now.
No, I don't. He's got to do that himself.
All right, Dr. Sweet, if you can hear us, would you mind hitting the unmute button so the board can hear you? And since he is here, if you wanted to go forward a chair, hopefully he can get his audio open up.
Can you hear that?
Yes, we can hear you now, Dr. Sweet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry about that, Chair.
That's fine. This is case number... And we got case number 24-250, initial interview with Dr. Frank Sweet. And Ms. Anthony, could you give us an overview of this?
Yes. Dr. Sadlec, members of the board, on June 5th, 2023, the board received a self-report notice from attorney Flynn Carey on behalf of Dr. Frank Sweet. The notice disclosed Dr. Sweet was charged with a DUI on May 20th, 2023, and that his case was pending in the Parker Magistrate Court. On February 27th, 2024, the board received notice of resolution of the DUI case. The case was resolved as a reckless driving plea to include the following. Dr. Sweet pled guilty to reckless driving, a class 2 misdemeanor, fines of $610.30, 12 months probation with the following terms, attend substance abuse assessment, complete 7 days in-home detention, and no illegal drugs or alcohol during the term of probation.
Dr. Sweet, your feedback?
You want me to comment on that?
Yes, please.
Well, yeah, that's what happened. So, yeah, that's what transpired.
Okay.
So I pled to reckless driving. That was the charge.
And your probation just started in February of 2024?
Yes, sir. I think that's correct.
Okay. And are you currently having any difficulty meeting your probation?
No, not at all. No.
Okay. So, board members, we have a couple of choices that I see, and it's, let me run it by you, and then you can come up with maybe some solutions. We do have the issue of violation ARS 32-1501-31. We could do a letter of concern and let it sit at that, along with a non-disciplinary 30 hours for CME. I'm going to kind of put it out to the board and let the board discern what they'd like to do.
And Chair, this is Flynn Carey. If at any point I had a few comments, if the board is not leaning towards a letter of concern, I did have some additional comments that might provide some additional guidance and information that in crafting a solution here as well.
Thank you, Mr. Carey.
Go ahead. And let's see what your proposal is.
Go ahead, Ms. Carey.
I just wanted to let the board know that Ms. Anthony, in preparing her summary, included a suggestion for PBI, the PBI course, which he has actually already registered for. So he has essentially been proactive on that. He's also actually resolved the vast majority of items on Ms. Anthony's list, including paying off his court fines. He attended a MAD impact panel. He had a substance assessment. The one that's pending right now is PBI. He's obviously paid and is going to go forward and take care of that so whether you order it or not, that's in the hopper already. I would also note that this is not, and I did a supplement just so the board had more info. This is not a alcohol DUI. It's actually a DUI allegation that came out of a singular prescription case. He was in Mexico for dental care and was given a medication before he returned to Arizona. So this was one of the reasons this did resolve as reckless is I think the prosecutor and his defense attorney properly did see it as a reckless situation and not as a case where, cases I think you often see, which is a doctor consumes alcohol and then makes the decision to drive. Or a doctor has an illegal substance in their system. This was truly a medication, what we call a drug DUI or a medication DUI. And given the nature of it, it's why it resolved the way it did. So it's a little different than I think what the board normally encounters. I would note, though, that he did take it seriously. He's completed the laundry list that Gail suggested and is currently pending that PBI course. So I think, regardless of if you do it through an NDCA or you were to do a letter of concern, he's paid for it. So he will be attending that and he can certainly provide proof to Ms. Anthony.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carey. Board members, your thought process?
This is Dr. Spott. Could I ask Dr. Squeet a couple questions, please?
Go ahead, Dr. Spott.
Yes, I'd like to know, so do you, did the judge make any judgment regarding about, do you get like interlock admission at all, or do they require you to do that or no?
No, because I don't drink at all. I don't drink alcohol. There's no alcohol involved in the DUI. So I've never used alcohol in my life. So I don't think that was a factor.
It's also to the member's question, under the law, it changed about 2.5-3 years ago. When you have a prescription or I guess an illegal drug, DUI, if you were convicted, there's no interlock requirement anymore. It's only for alcohol DUIs. But also he did plead guilty to a reckless, so he didn't trigger the interlock regardless.
I see. Okay. Thank you for clarification on that.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
That's all the question I have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Then let me move on to Dr. Campbell. Dr. Campbell, any thoughts?
I appreciate Dr. Sweet being upfront and frank with the board as far as his reporting requirement. And then also completing the list of recommended courses that the board director had documented. I think if we wanted to do some type of what were you thinking, Mr. Chairman? Were you thinking a consent agreement, or were you thinking a non-disciplinary letter?
You know, we'd probably defer to Mr. Hutchinson, but we probably would need to make sure that he is going to do his, it'd be through consent, his PBI form, that class. That's in addition to his 30 and the non-disciplinary CME or AKA MDC. And then it's up to the board, probably would to attach it all in a package, having the letter of concern with the violation of ARS 32-1501-31 might be the easiest way to move this along for Dr. Sweet and for the board.
All right. I can't speak for the other members, but I would be in favor of that.
Ms. Gallen, your opinion?
I'm just trying to think about it. I'm not sure if I would agree with that or not. I'm thinking about it.
Dr. Spatt, your thought process?
Yeah, I agree with some of the proposal you make, but also I like to see if regarding about consent form, and also if there's the probation period, we should be aligned with what the judge have put down for Dr. Sweet already, so that it can concur at the same period. So I think it's 11 months or 12 months. I think that's what we're going to do as well. So that's my thought on that.
I'm fairly confident that Dr. Sweet will do as the court ordered him, the 12 months.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'm obviously, if he didn't, then we would be informed.
Yeah. Because I think he come forward and he admit to his wrongdoing. So I think your proposal, I like your proposal. Let's ask Ms. Diva to see what her thought process at the moment, so we can close this.
Okay.
So I had a couple of concerns, but I'm not sure if those concerns are something we're able to discuss. Is it possible to go into executive session? I'm sorry to drag everybody in.
Sure. Do you want to make a motion then to go into executive?
Yeah. I'm gonna make a motion to go into executive session.
For legal advice?
For legal advice.
Okay.
Okay.
Is there a second?
We will go into executive session.
I need a second, please.
I'll second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
12:16, I'll see you in executive session. Gail, do you show her up? Do you show Miss Gallen up?
I don't know if that's her or not. Oh, there she is. Miss Gallen?
Miss Gallen, you back?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. I don't know. It muted me and I didn't know how to unmute. I apologize.
No problem. So we're back in session. We have do you want to do roll call one more time, Gail?
Yes. Dr. Spatt?
Here.
Dr. Sadlick?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Ms. Gallen?
Here.
We have quorum.
Okay. All right. We were trying to come up with closure for this case, and we have some further discussion to do. So, excuse me, Ms. Gallen, do you have other comments or suggestions?
Yeah, I had just voiced the concern that that he has been in front of the board previously and received a letter of concern. So I'm not sure how we want to handle that, if we're okay that this is something different and we want to handle it differently, or if we want to make sure there's closure on this and we monitor him with some kind of consent agreement to make sure that there's follow through.
Okay, good point. Dr. Spatz, how you feel?
Yes, I agree with what Ms. Gallen's saying, but how are we gonna proceed it though?
Okay, and Dr. Campbell, your thoughts?
I concur.
Okay. Ms. Gallen, could you give us your thoughts or at least your suggestions on his consent agreement?
I'm not sure, like, if we actually even want to go down that route, if we decide that that's in his best interest and the public, then I would maybe suggest something along the lines of whatever length of time he needs to make sure everything is completed. So that would be how long maybe I would offer the consent agreement for, and just to see that everything has been completed in that time frame.
So his CME, according to his attorney, he has enrolled in PBI, and he also has other items that he's completing for the state. Were you thinking of possibly having his consent agreement run until after his probation period ends, which would be a year from February?
I mean, that would make the most sense. If we decide to do a consent agreement, that would make the most sense to me. I'm not saying that that's necessary if everybody else feels differently, but if we have concerns just based on multiple board appearances and just the nature of what's going on, then that would be my suggestion.
Okay. Okay.
So just off the spot, so Ms. Gallen, so you would like the trailman of executive from the executive date of a consent agreement?
I would just think, and I don't know what everybody else's opinion on this is. My thoughts is just, so we're, whatever that means, so I guess a year, so we're able to see that everything has been efficiently followed through.
Mr. Pasquale, I agree with that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I just don't know how to word it. So maybe Mr. Hutchinson can help us with those, but I don't know how to word those.
This is Dr. Campbell. I can attempt to make some type of a consent agreement. I'd like to make a motion that we offer Dr. Sweet a consent agreement with the following terms. And I don't know if we are obligated to make it a year from today's date or if we can go back, if we were to go back, you know, a couple of months to February, I don't know if it would be, if that's what the board wanted to do. I heard it said once or twice. I don't know if it'd be better to offer a 6-month or an 8-month consent agreement. So we can work on that. However, within 6 months from today's date, Dr. Sweet must submit proof of completion and the results of the court ordered substance abuse assessment. Also within 3 months of the execution date of the consent agreement, respondent or Dr. Sweet must submit proof of payment of all of his court ordered fines. Within 6 months of the execution date of the consent agreement, the respondent must complete 15 hours in ethics and professionalism, which would be in line with the board's philosophy, would be completed above the 30-hour CME required for his yearly renewal. We would also mandate within the consent agreement to complete the ME15 PBI course. I don't feel that we need to, at this point, that's just my opinion, I don't feel we need an independent substance evaluation performed. Again, this is not our typical DUI, and the actual conviction is not for DUI, it's for a reckless charge, and so I don't think we need to bring that into consideration, but that's, again, just my opinion. And Mr. Hutchinson, did you have anything to add, sir?
No, it sounds like this is would the board, assuming the board voted in favor, this is it based on, I guess I got two questions, based on the information and the statute violations included in the investigative report is my first one. I'm assuming yes, but I want to confirm. And then my second one is, because it seems like the board's concerned with making sure that he has a follow through, there's some sort of mechanism to make sure he complies with the requirements. Would the board include any sort of early termination, or is it, do you want it, does the board want it to run concurrently with the criminal probation?
Well, my first answer to number one is yes. And then, you know, if we wanted to simply put him on probation for a year, and if we wanted to say, hey, you know, if it's 6 months time, you know, given, you know, the 3 month and the 6 month timelines that we've already talked about, if we wanted to say, if everything is done at 6 months and there has been no other board cases, everything else is good, the court's happy, you know, everything is good to go, that his probation ends at that 6 month juncture, I'm fine with that. I don't know how the other board members feel about that, but I would be you know, at that point, if everything is done, all of our courses, classes, the court's happy, everybody's happy, and there's been no other problems, I would be, you know, okay with that.
So, Dr. Salek, members of the board, this is Gail. So, Dr. Campbell, would that be a portion that he can request early probation at 6-month juncture, as long as everything was completed to the board's satisfaction? Is that what I'm hearing?
That sounds good to me.
Okay. Thank you.
And the only other thing we may want to add, and I'm sure Dr. Sweet will make sure that he completes his probation with the state, which ends a year from February. Other than that, Dr. Kim, I think that's a good motion.
Yeah, great point, Mr. Chairman. Of course, if there were any issues after we were to cut him loose in 6 months and, you know, 2 months after that, we found out that there was a violation of that, then naturally we would have to, we would come back and not only address the violation, but the issue, you know, at hand. So thank you.
And one more clarification, please. If in the event he does not sign the consent agreement within 15 days, this matter goes directly to formal interview?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Gail, do I need to second motion on regarding Dr. Campbell motion?
Yes, we need a second.
Okay, just flip the spot. I second that.
And
roll call, please.
Go ahead, Gail.
Dr. Spratt?
Yeah.
Dr. Campbell?
My apologies. Are we saying aye?
Yeah, yes, aye.
Aye for Dr. Campbell.
Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Ms. Gallin?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. Dr. Sweet.
Thank you.
Can I ask real quick what the term, the length of probation was? I think I got everything else.
I think it was for 12 months originally, and then he can request at that juncture.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Got it. Okay. So let's go ahead and we'll move on to Dr. Tate, Carolyn Kate, case number 24-248. And this is the initial interview. And ask Ms. Anthony for an overview.
Dr. Salek, members of the board, this is case 24-248. On 1-8 of 2023, the board received a complaint from an inpatient psychiatric physician regarding one of respondents' patients. However, the complainant did not disclose the patient name. Board staff ran an AZ-CSPMP report and discovered several patients listed that could fit the listed drug prescription prescribed in the complaint. During an interview with the complainant on 1-18-2024, staff confirmed the patient was CO. According to the complainant, CO was initially seen at Scottsdale Osborne Emergency Department for what he described as a near-fatal overdose. Upon ER discharge, CO was admitted for a psychiatric evaluation for possible attempted suicide and was evaluated by complainants. According to the complainant, CO has a documented history of depression. However, the overdose was categorized as accidental. The complainant stated he spoke with respondent via phone call, and based on their discussion, respondent agreed she would not prescribe to DO again. When asked about ketamine, the complainant stated it is not approved for anyone for at-home use, that currently there are several studies being conducted. However, those studies are in-clinic studies that include close patient observations. According to the AZ CSPMP run specific to CO, he saw a physician, Dr. Khan, MD, from 3-2-2022 to 2-8-2023, and Zolpidem was the primary prescription written. Ketamine was not prescribed. On 2-8-2023, Dr. Khan wrote a prescription for Zolpidem number 30 to patient CO. Records indicate it was filled by the patient that same day. CO presented to respondent for the first time 13 days later on 2-21-23, and respondent wrote a prescription for Zolpidem number 30. CO filled the prescription 3 days later. Respondent added ketamine to the prescribing routine on 3-16-2023. During the course of the investigation, patient records for WS, DS, and CW were also subpoenaed. Patient WS, the CSP repeat report run 1-1-21 through 2-26-24 reflects respondent prescribed 37 prescriptions for ketamine and 4 prescriptions for testosterone during that time frame. Respondent provided one chart note dated 12-22-23. One lab report included in the chart dated 12-22-23 reflects high testosterone levels. According to the CSPMP, respondent had been prescribing testosterone since 11-21 of 22. It's unknown if she performed previous labs or what the results may have been. Her last prescription was dated the same date as the lab test, so it is unknown if she notified the patient to reduce or discontinue the testosterone based on the labs. The CSPMP also indicated respondent had been prescribing ketamine since 10-28 of 22. Because there are no prior records included in her chart, it's unknown if the patient was referred out for pain or a psychological evaluation. The current chart does not mention referral. It does note a diagnosis of PTSD and anxiety disorder and mild depression, but it is unknown where those originated from. Patient DS, possibly related to WS, the CSPMP report reflects respondent provided 38 prescriptions for ketamine, 7 prescriptions for testosterone, and 1 prescription for alprazolam. The chart notes provided by respondent begin 11-8-23, run through 12-22-23. Although labs were ordered in November of 2023, the results were not included in the charts provided by respondent. The CSPMP also indicates respondent had been prescribing ketamine since 7-20 of 2022. Because there are no prior records included in her chart, it is unknown if the patient was referred out for pain or psychological evaluation. Patient CW, the report runs from 1-21 to 2-24, reflects respondent provided 12 prescriptions for ketamine, 11 prescriptions for lorazepam, 3 prescriptions for alprazolam, 6 prescriptions for modafinil, and several prescriptions for what's listed as a compounded drug product during that time frame. The chart notes provided by respondent begin 11-8-2023 and run through 1-11-2024. The CSPMP also indicates respondent had been prescribing ketamine since 7-20 of 2022. Because there are no prior records included in her chart, it's unknown if the patient was referred out for pain or psychological evaluation. Respondent wrote prescriptions for ketamine along with a combination of other drugs to COWS, CS, and CW without any documented referral for pain or psychiatric evaluation. When asked how much additional education she holds in the areas of psychology, psychiatric medication counseling beyond what she was taught at Southwest College prior to her graduation in 2015, respondent stated, quote, I have received no additional training in psychology other than my doctoral degree. I have attended various lectures and conferences like 4AM, where I was exposed to using ketamine for psychological and pain control concerns, end quote.
Dr. Tay, do you have a legal representation?
Yes, Mandy Carvis.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Mandy. Will you be, Dr. Tay, will you be speaking? Do you want to respond or will Ms. Carvis do it?
Yes, good morning, good afternoon, Dr. Sadalek. I will be responding and Dr. Tay will be available to answer questions from the board if there are any. I presume, since we have not heard anything as of yet, that the complainant is not present and wishing to speak. Okay, so I guess one of the big picture things that the board needs to be mindful of, that I don't think was emphasized in the prior summary, is that Dr. Tade provided care to all of the patients whose charts were provided at her prior practice, Fusion Medical, and then resumed care for them at her current practice, Dose Medical. We did inform the board that she no longer had access to the charts from Fusion, and that those would need to be requested directly from Fusion. I don't know if those charts were requested and not provided, or just not requested. Without having access to them specifically, Dr. Tade can't comment based on recollection in terms of what was or was not in those records. However, she felt that she had a good enough understanding of these patients and the issues and conditions that they were requesting treatment for to begin to care for them at Dose Medical without getting copies of their prior chart. Going forward, if she is going to care for other patients from her prior practice, she acknowledges that it may be better practice to obtain those records just for the sake of completeness, but she did feel familiar enough with those patients in order to provide them with treatment. With respect to the patient CO who the complaint originated from, she did not have any prior knowledge that he had any history of suicide attempt or improper use or misuse of prescription medications. There's a dispute as to whether or not it was a true suicide attempt or an accidental overdose. There was a reference in the complaint that he reportedly took a month worth of ketamine and Xanax. I'm not sure that could ever be verified or not. With respect to that situation, obviously providers can prescribe responsibly and provide their patients with instructions to take medications responsibly, but they obviously cannot force someone to take medications properly, and they certainly cannot predict if someone is going to take them improperly in an attempt to end their life. When that particular patient did try to renew prescriptions later on, those refills were denied due to patient safety concerns. With respect to the other patients and those charts, they would fall in the same category as to whether or not the prior records are available from Fusion or not. And with respect to ketamine and at-home use, again, that there are a lot of studies going on presently. It was initially being administered in a clinic setting. It is now, however, and has been for over a year, prescribed for at-home use and has been shown to be effective. If the board has questions for Dr. Tade as to how frequently she prescribes ketamine, under what circumstances, why that is part of a medication regimen, she'd be happy to answer those questions. I think those are probably more appropriately addressed by her. But we believe that her prescriptions for these patients, for CO in particular, were appropriate and met the standard of care. And again, it was beyond her control if the patient utilized those medications in an inappropriate manner. She is present and happy to answer any questions that the members of the board may have, and we appreciate the opportunity to be heard today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Garvis. Dr. Tade, I have a couple questions, and then the board members do too, I'm sure. When you are evaluating these patients, what's your criteria? Are you using the DSM-5, or how are you assessing their current psychological status?
Yes, I use the DSM-5 as a framework, but I also talk to them about their sleep, their energy, their appetite, their activity level, their mood overall, and their mental state. Like, or if they're having low motivation, if they are feeling anxious, if they're having panic attacks. I really try to do an in-depth psychological evaluation on every patient. Unfortunately, those initial conversations with those patients are in my records back at Fusion, and I have attempted to get records from them. I think Gail has subpoenaed records from Fusion as well, and we have been unsuccessful in getting those initial records that when I, you know, I initiated care with those patients.
And then with these patients that you're treating with medications, are they being referred out for psychotherapy, to psychology, any other mental health provider that they're being referred to for therapy?
Yes. So one of the patients in particular sees her therapist twice a week, and I am in contact with him. We email back and forth probably once a month just to track her progress. Some of the other patients, WS in particular, he is seen at the VA, and he has done TMS and IV ketamine treatments. So he has a long history of mental health therapies. So I do encourage counseling while they're doing this therapy. Some patients will see a counselor while they're doing this, and I'm happy to work with the counselor and kind of guide them through this therapy. However, some are more resistant to it.
And are any of these patients first tried with SSRIs, or do you just move them directly to ketamine?
No, every patient that I have given ketamine to has failed at least one, if not two, SSRIs. That is one of the main indications for ketamine is treatment-resistant depression. Some patients didn't like the side effects from traditional antidepressants, like sexual side effects, weight gain, emotional numbness, but all of my patients have tried and failed at least one SSRI.
Okay, and besides the SSRIs, Wellbutrin, et cetera, do you try those medications also?
I have in the past. Again, the benefit of ketamine is that it, you know, it's exceptionally safe when used correctly. And it also provides, you know, results that are deeper than surface level symptom relief. It helps to provide new connections in the brain. So patients that have had a long history of psychological ailments really can benefit from this.
And besides the training, as was stated at the beginning, have you had any other additional training in psychotherapy or patient contact type therapeutics?
Yes, I did a course in motivational interviewing back when I was at SC&M. I regularly attend conferences, A4M, where we talk about these alternative therapies to approach mental health issues.
Okay. I'm going to ask the other board members to give me some feedback. Dr. Campbell, can I start with you?
If you could actually skip me right now, I would appreciate it.
No problem. Dr. Spatt?
Yes. Hi, Dr. Tate. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you.
All right. So I just want, so with the ketamine that you prescribe now, is that the oral? Or I just want to make sure. Is that oral? Or is that you giving IV or IM?
No, no, no. It is not within our scope to give IM or IV ketamine. Okay. I generally prescribe it as a troche or as a nasal spray for at-home use.
I see. Okay. And then when you prescribe, do you check on the Arizona, the PMP farm base at all for some of this patient?
For every patient, because ketamine is a controlled substance.
So you do check on them?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And then the other thing is the, so give me, educate me on this. So how much do you start out, let's say for a, let's say 18 to 25 years old, how much do you start out and what, at what range, and how do you evaluate, and also how do you, just go ahead.
For an 18 to 25 year old patient?
Yes.
Okay. So ketamine is typically dosed based on body weight. The safe dosage, safe calculation is 1 milligram per kilogram per dose. Most of my patients, troche is a very common option. I typically dose at 100 milligrams, 50 sometimes if I'm being conservative, 50 milligrams if they're sensitive, maybe 100 milligrams if they're a little bit bigger, or, you know, larger in body weight. The troche, though, only has about a 20 to 30% bioavailability for oral consumption. So the troche is a really great way to do this. Of course, you want to do an evaluation. And, you know, for this patient in particular, I really should have asked him maybe, you know, more questions about his history of substance abuse, if he had an addictive personality. When I spoke with the complainant, Dr. LaProust, he did tell me that the patient displayed very manipulative behavior, kind of like drug-seeking behavior. So I think in the future, and with anyone that's going to be considering prescribing this at home, doing a little bit more in-depth screening to make sure that this is appropriate for the patient.
Okay, so you mentioned that you have prescribed this frequently. So let's say the patient used the troche. How soon, let's say after, let's say Monday, you give it to them and they take it on Monday. Mm-hmm. How soon afterward are you evaluating them or follow up with them?
I follow up my patients every 6 weeks once they initiate care. Once they're stable on, you know, they're happy with the dosing, they're getting appropriate symptom relief, I follow up with them every 3 months. I will only prescribe any controlled medication for a 3-month supply. And that's a really good time just to circle back with them, see if there's any changes to their medications, their psychological state. So yeah, 6-week follow-up, about 45 days, and then 90 days.
Okay. So is there any blood tests that need to be done during the follow-up at all?
Specifically for ketamine?
Yes.
No. Ketamine doesn't seem to impact organ function. Most of my patients are getting blood work done. If they are a hormone patient, every 3 to 6 months. So we usually try to run that at the same time as their follow-up appointment for the ketamine.
Okay. So what, let's say a patient take the ketamine and then they have side effect. Do you tell them to go to the ER or do they contact you? How that work out for your emergency response?
Ketamine has a very low side effect profile when taken appropriately. I haven't had any patients had, you know, extreme side effects. Of course, if there's anything, you know, abnormal, I always encourage them to seek urgent care. Most of the time they'll just call me. Number one side effect is maybe just dizziness. And so I just tell them, stay home, relax. If it increases or it gets worse, of course, seek urgent care.
Okay. What age range do you usually have on your patient that use the ketamine? Because I know that like naturopath using it nowadays, but I just want to know, since you on the case, I just want to see what your opinion is. And what was the age limit that you do and so forth?
Most of my ketamine patients are in their 30s and 40s, maybe late 20s. I really don't see a lot of pediatrics.
Okay, I see. Okay. All right. Thank you. That's all I have for Dr. Tate, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Spatt. Ms. Gallen?
I don't have anything to add right now.
Okay. And Dr. Campbell, let me circle back to you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Doctor. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, thank you. With regard to, some of my questions have already been answered. You know, when we talk about patients who come into your office, especially, you know, like referred via the VA, which is a very highly vulnerable population, and kind of getting a better understanding for your patient when they come in, I understand that you said that in the future that you would like to make sure that you do a more comprehensive evaluation. When a patient comes in and essentially indicates that they've been experiencing issues with no mental health issues with no luck and ketamine comes up,
do you discuss their family history of psychological problems at all?
Yes, family history is really important. I typically will go through, you know, parents and maternal grandparents, paternal parents, as well, I ask them this as well for if there's any disease processes like diabetes, cancer, mental health. So I try to go back to at least their grandparents.
Okay. And with regard to ideation or behavior with regard to patients experiencing dissociative or symptoms, do you discuss that, you know, if they've ever experienced those type of symptoms?
Specifically, if I've asked them if they've had a dissociative episode?
Correct.
I generally do not.
Okay. Well, the reason that I'm asking is with the home care, I know you said that your common protocol is a 6-week follow-up. Mm-hmm. However, in my experience, a lot of physicians will actually, you know, when somebody is just starting out on the medication, they might do a telemed follow-up within 24 to 48 hours to connect with that patient to get that, you know, to make sure that they're describing what's happening and that if you pick up on anything that's concerning at that point, you know, that you can direct more comprehensive care at that point, you know, whether it's, yeah, you know, stopping or adjusting the dose, that kind of thing.
Right.
With regard to ketamine, and I know that, that you already asked with regard to a little bit more advanced training, have you ever taken a dosing course regarding ketamine specifically, and current, you know, treatment recommendations and things of that nature?
The conferences that I have attended have dosing suggestions. There's also several online clinics that offer at-home ketamine, and I also have been kind of following their dosing schedule.
Okay. All right. And then also, do you have any education with separate from the patient with regard to their ketamine use at home? Like, is there any education on behalf of any family members or caretakers or roommates or whoever might be around with regard to signs to look for, you know, how to respond to a potential emergency or side effects related to the ketamine, that sort of thing?
That is a great suggestion. I don't have anything like that I send home with the patient. Is that what
it could be something of that nature, or you know, where a patient would you would educate the patient to educate a family member, you know, or mm-hmm. or you could send something home, documentation for them, you know, for somebody to sign that they understand, you know, the different side effects and things to look for initially and things of that nature. And then also an emergency plan, you know, patients should have clear instructions, you know, to who that they should contact in case of severe side effects or any concerns, whether that's 24/7, you know, 911 emergency control, ER, your office, you know, things of that nature as well.
Right. Yeah, I can definitely work on a handout like that to send home with people.
Okay. Now with regard to everything, taking kind of, you know, a 360 degree, look at everything, how do you feel besides the things that we've just discussed, how do you feel that you can improve upon the situation so we don't have a repeat here?
And it's, this particular patient, CO, had been, you know, very compliant with his medications up until this point. He had been, you know, using ketamine under my supervision for almost a year. So it's very odd that all of a sudden he would take such a massive dose. So unfortunately, you know, when I talked to the complainant, Dr. LaPrade, he said it was accidental, and it's very hard to accidentally take that much ketamine as a troche, you know? Mm-hmm. So like I was saying, I was like, I should definitely do some additional screening on patients, making sure they do not have a history of, you know, suicidality, dissociative, like you were saying, and that they do not have any history of addiction or drug abuse. I do like this idea of sending them home with something to give their roommate, their partner, their spouse. So if they have any side effects, what the next step should be.
Okay. And with regard to checking in with the patient, you know, a lot sooner than 6 weeks, yes. You know, maybe even like that do you offer telemed or anything like yes. that? Mm-hmm. Do you think that with regard to future prescribing that you could establish a 24, you know, or 48-hour follow-up so that you can, you know, understand what that patient is feeling, any concerns that they might have? You can lay eyes on that patient's face and eyes and kind of get a feeling if there's anything that's, you know, concerning to you, that sort of thing?
Absolutely.
All right. You know, if I come to you and I, you know, I say that I've been, you know, experiencing depression, maybe PTSD is the result of, you know, some type of event, and my primary care provider in another state before I moved here prescribed Zoloft and I didn't have much luck with it, and I'd like to try ketamine. Are you going to be getting my medical records and confirming some things before we start writing, you know, scripts for ketamine, or how would that first visit go?
Ketamine is very rarely a first line therapy. And if I have a patient coming into my clinic asking me for ketamine, that's kind of a red flag. If they are within the state, I usually pull their AZPMP report to see what they've been prescribed before. And then, of course, in my history, I always ask them, what have you tried? What medications, what therapies, et cetera. And then I usually do request medical records if they, are seen by a specialist. I also tell them I'm not a mental health specialist. I don't generally like to, you know, be in charge of prescribing all these psych meds. However, and maybe this is just, you know, his manipulative behavior, but CO was especially insistent that he didn't like to work with psychiatrists. They hadn't served him well in the past. So, you know, I think a big part of that is just doing my due diligence and, requesting records and checking AZPMP and just talking to the patient about what they've tried before.
Definitely. Now, with regard to psychiatric evaluation, mm-hmm. If you have, you know, if a patient, you know, comes in and you're heading towards that prescribing of ketamine and they say, well, you know, I haven't had good luck with therapists. I don't really like therapists and I would rather not have to deal with anything, you know, like that.
Yeah.
In that kind of a situation, you know, maybe if they've had a psychological evaluation within 6-12 months, you can request that, read that. But say, you know, it's been a few years since they've been in front of anybody. You know, we really don't have a good understanding of what's happening at home in their, you know, in their personal life, you know, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Would you ever consider ordering a psychological assessment or requiring that they go and, you know, say, well, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, you're going to have to bring me some type of, you know, letter from a licensed practitioner that says that, you know, that you're okay and we don't have any concerns. Mm-hmm. Do you think that would be a crucial thing to do? Is that anything that you have done in the past where you've actually mandated that of a patient prior to prescribing?
Yes. I do work with, so I have several counselors that I work with. And so if a patient starts his therapy, I do give them those counselors' names, numbers, information about how to reach out and set up appointments with them. I do work with a psychiatrist that does, the counseling in their office with the ketamine troches that I provide. So I'm in close contact with them and I'm happy to send out for psychological evaluation.
Okay. And, do you really take an in-depth approach to family history with them? Is that on your intake form, family history? You know, is there, you know, maybe in addition to, you know, the forms that we send home, there can be an additional form that a patient who's going to be prescribed ketamine fills out as part of their initial assessment, where you're taking a deeper dive into, you know, their family history, substance use history, that sort of thing, because specifically, their family history, if they have a history of dissociative disorders or other, specific psychiatric conditions, you know, that can actually, you know, that it's actually, you know, known to create a higher risk, and just things that you can, you know, document for your benefit, prior to prescribing so that you're covered in the event something like this was to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and different things that, you know, that you can, you know, try to catch before they happen kind of thing. But again, that's nothing that, you know, that I'm sitting here telling you that you have to do. These are just things that have crossed my thought process as we've been just, you know, talking. Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, I don't have any other questions at this time.
Okay. And I have a couple questions. You're prescribing of diazepam versus lorazepam.
Yes.
Can you describe to me what the differentiation is and why you use one versus the other?
For which patient in particular?
I'm just looking at your prescribing history. So I'm looking at your PMP prescribing history.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is your diazepam prescription on 1/12/24. I'm just looking for the pharmacology. I'm not looking right now at the patient. And then I'm looking for your lorazepam on 9/20/23. Do you have a preference to how you prescribe those? And if so, why?
So it's really up to the patient. I generally prescribe diazepam more for insomnia, so I prescribe it more at night. Lorazepam I use more for daytime anxiety or acute breakthrough anxiety, as it is not as sedating for daytime use. However, every patient I treat individually. So some people prefer lorazepam at night. Some people prefer diazepam during the day. It's just up to patient's response to the medication.
Okay. And then give me some feedback on your modafinil prescriptions.
Modafinil is a it helps with focus and attention. I don't find that it is as stimulating as Adderall or Vyvanse or Concerta. I prefer it that way because a lot of my patients that have been on Adderall before, CO in particular, he was prescribed Adderall by his previous provider. He did not like how he felt afterwards. So after the Adderall wore off, he would have a significant crash. So we chose modafinil for him. It seemed to help with his focus during the day. However, it didn't give him that like crash, that like dopamine crash that a lot of, you know, Adderall, Concerta, Vyvanse seems to do.
Okay. Do you feel as though with your benzodiazepine patients,
mm-hmm.
Do you combine the benzodiazepine and then are you using modafinil also?
Sometimes. Not all the time. I hate to get in this like cycle of like, you know, but then a lot of them are like too anxious to sleep. So then you give them a benzo and then they feel tired during the day. So you get in this like vicious cycle, which I don't love, but some patients respond to it. Some patients don't do well with it.
Okay. And in reference to the benzodiazepine, are you using any opioid treatments with the benzodiazepine?
No, never.
Okay. Yeah, my concerns that I have are, you know, as follows. when a patient comes in to see you, brand new patient, are you running a PMP on them?
If a patient is getting a controlled substance, hormones, testosterone, if they're requesting refills of, you know, Ambien, Lyraz, all of that sort of thing, lorazepam, I generally will run a PMP. That's not every patient though. Some of my patients just come to see me for thyroid or gut health or that sort of thing. So those are more like low risk patients. I generally don't run a PMP on them.
Okay, because there was a crossover with the the provider, as you know, is open. How did if someone comes in for insomnia, if they want Ambien, and basically, what's your protocol?
I had pulled his, well, and then these are records from Fusion. I generally make a note in my treatment plan when I have pulled the AZPMP. Of course, I don't have access to those notes. Generally, I do. If they are asking for a refill, I go on the AZPMP. I see when it was refilled. I will generally call it into the pharmacy that same day, but I will tell the pharmacy not to action that refill until the day after their current prescription has run out.
Okay, and if they come back for refills, what's your protocol? Do you pull a PMP again?
Generally, yes, just to make sure there's no cross-prescribing or that they are not seeing multiple providers.
Okay, because a lot of times, as you know, they are seeing multiple providers.
Mm-hmm.
Don't pull a PMP. You really have no control over what medications they're taking in terms of medications that could be potentially difficult, such as benzodiazepines, such as the sedatives, et cetera.
Right.
And then if you combine those with ketamine, then obviously, as you know, then there's problems.
Right.
So my concern, basically, my two concerns come from the prescribing habits and then the ability that these patients are getting some type of therapeutic, i.e., therapist, psychologist, whatever, you know, insurance will cover for them, but they need some type of professional follow-up therapy, not just medications and being sent on their way.
Yes. No, I agree.
And what's the story with Fusion? How come they won't give us records that we need for your case?
I have personally requested records from them as well since I opened this practice in like late October, early November, and I have been unsuccessful in getting any records from them either. I left Fusion in at the end of July, early August.
And how were those records? Were those, did Fusion use the EMR of some sort?
Yes, Fusion uses ECW, and on my last day there, when I finished all of my chart notes, they locked me out.
Okay.
So, and I do think Gail has done a really good job. I think she subpoenaed those records as well, and it seems like we haven't been able to get those.
Perhaps the Mr. Attorney General can get involved with that, so that's unacceptable.
Yeah, I at this point, board members, I'd like those records to see exactly how much psychological is put into the patient, i.e. in terms of evaluation, and also the prescribing habits based on the psychological issue that the patient comes up with. And it's difficult to do that if we don't have the records that we need that Dr. Tate's stating that she has over there.
And Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this is Gail. If I may, I did send a subpoena over there as well for those records, and it was just sent back to the board.
Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead, Dr. Spatt.
Yeah, just Dr. Spatt. I just have a few questions asked of the Tate. So at your clinic at the moment, what type of patient usually, I know you mentioned a few patients like Tyrone and so, but what are the bulk of your patients? Are they like majority are mental health or insomnia, or what type of patient you usually have?
You know, I really try to practice a well-rounded primary care. I do a lot of endocrinology. I do a lot of gut health. I really see a wide variety of patients.
Okay. My main concern is because when I look at the PMP and how much you're prescribing ketamine, I feel like you are an expert who practicing like an MD. It's the allopathic. Instead of naturopath. So I just wondering, what other alternative treatment do you usually offer to your patient besides prescribing medication?
We do IV therapy here. I do a specialty testing on neurotransmitters, gut health. I run a lot of lab testing to check hormones and inflammation. I try to treat the patient as holistically as possible. When you're seeing all these ketamine prescriptions, I only allow the patient to have a 30-day supply at a time, and I only allow them to have 2 refills. So that really encourages the patient to come back into the office at the end of that 90-day cycle if they would like to continue therapy.
Okay. Gail? Since we don't have the fusion medical record, can we tailor this to next month?
Yes, you can. The board can do whatever the board wants to do. I don't know how I'm going to get those records, being they are refusing to do anything with the subpoena. They just sent it back. So, Casey, do you have any suggestions on that?
I mean, usually the person being subpoenaed is a practitioner before the board. So off the cuff, I don't have any good answers right now, but I could certainly look into it.
Yeah, if you could, please, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, so I my motion at the moment is if we could tailor this case to the next month hearing, so that we can get more information instead of making our decision now.
Okay. Is that your motion, Dr. Spatt?
Yes, if I may.
For motion for more discovery from, it looks like Fusion Medical.
Yes.
Okay. I'll second that motion, and the reason I'm seconding it is I need more data as to how the medications are prescribed, what conditions they're prescribed for, i.e. is it insomnia, is it mild depression, is it moderate depression, what else has been tried. So I need that in some type of format to make a decision. So I'll second your motion, Dr. Spatt.
Well, thank you.
In roll call, please. Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's move on to case number. This is Dr. Nelson, and this is case number 24-247. Initial interview, and I have Nathan to give us an overview.
And Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, on January 3rd, 2024, the board received a complaint from Timothy Campbell regarding his grandmother, LMC, who was treated by respondent in December of 2023. The board received a follow-up complaint the next day from Mr. Campbell as well, who alleges respondent prescribed several medications to LMC, who was visiting Vermont at the time, causing side effects of stomach pain. It should be noted LMC is related to respondent. She is the mother of respondent's wife. The complainant in this case is the grandson of LMC. Respondent has provided the board with a notarized statement to the board signed by LMC, which indicates she and respondent have had a doctor-patient relationship for years. She goes on to explain in her statement that her grandchildren have some type of personal problem with respondent and apparently prompted this complaint. This complaint appears to be related to a dysfunctional family dynamic. Based on the information provided by respondent, this investigator believes the complaint should be dismissed.
Thank you. Dr. Nelson, are you on the line, or Ms. Carvis, are you representing him?
I do. Okay. Thank you. And Dr. Nelson is present as well. I believe Ms. Anthony provided a good summary of the situation. This is unfortunately the result of, as she just, I think aptly described it, a dysfunctional family dynamic. The patient has had a longstanding relationship with Dr. Nelson as needed when she is in Vermont part of the time and here in Arizona part of the time. She is happy with the care that she's received. There are no issues with it. Unfortunately, the complainant also has, I'll say, some strong feelings with respect to naturopathic medicine and its efficacy. And we believe that that prompted the complaint. And we obviously support Ms. Anthony's recommendation that this matter be dismissed. Should the members of the board have any questions for Dr. Nelson, he is available and happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Nelson, I just have a quick question. Are you also licensed in Vermont?
Yes, I'm licensed here in Arizona, and I have a telemedicine license in Vermont.
Okay. Any problems with the Vermont board?
No, Chairman.
Okay. And can you tell me real quick how your telemedicine license works with Vermont?
Vermont has had a shortage of care providers, which is partly why I've been involved in my the patient's care. And Vermont has identified that specifically during COVID. And to remedy the situation, they have now allowed any licensed primary care doctor in any of the states to apply for a telemedicine. It's a limited scope where you can provide telemedicine to your patients or new patients in Vermont, but it's limited to, I think, 20. And I am now have that. I'm now allowed to do that based on my application and acceptance.
So you'll do a telemedicine. You'll determine whether they need thyroid medication, antibiotic, et cetera.
I would basically, just as you would do a telemedicine here in Arizona, I would ascertain based on the patient's current symptoms, their history, any appropriate blood work, imaging studies. I would say it would be no different than if that person were here in Arizona. And if need be, obviously you would refer them to appropriate care, be it urgent care, which is in the case of the patient. We referred her to urgent care. We referred her to some orthopedist. We referred her to other people. And unfortunately, due to the lack of primary care availability, oftentimes our recommendations aren't met. And so that's partially what prompted the concern from the complainant.
Okay. Thank you. Now I understand now. Dr. Campbell, any questions for Dr. Nelson?
No questions.
Dr. Spad?
I don't have any questions either.
Okay. Ms. Gallen?
No questions at this time.
So if it's all right with the board, then I'd like to make a motion with Dr. Nelson that we dismiss this case number 24-247. I'll need a second, and then we'll need roll call.
This is Dr. Swat. I second that.
Roll call, please. Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Spat?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day, everyone.
You too.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and move on then to, we'll move on to case number 24-246. And this is, Dr. Beardsley.
Good afternoon, Leah Shacker on behalf of Dr. Beardsley, who is also present online.
And Ms. Anthony, could you give us an overview?
Yes. Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this is case 24-246. The board received a complaint from Julie Graninetti, alleging respondent treated her daughters, GB, age 16, and SB, age 13, without her consent or knowledge. According to the complaint, Ms. Graninetti is divorced and has 50% legal medical decision-making regarding her children. She alleges respondent provided unnecessary IVs to her children without her consent or knowledge, and that respondent provided the court with a letter that included false statements relating to past medical care provided to the family. According to the chart notes, although GB presented with symptoms sufficient enough to prescribe IVs and a nebulizer treatment, dates of service 5-8-2023 and 1-13-2022, respondent failed to take GB's temperature. According to the chart notes, although SB presented with symptoms sufficient enough to prescribe an IV, date of service 5-5-2023, respondent failed to take SB's temperature. Additionally, on 7-23, respondent provides SB with a sub-Q injection of a peptide combo without noting reason or medical necessity. SB's chart notes dated 5-5-2023 states, dispensed KBMO food panel test kit to father for at-home testing, but does not note the reason or the medical necessity for this test.
Thank you. Shafton, are you going to be speaking for your client, or is she going to be available?
Yes, I would like to address the board.
Yes, please.
Thank you. So obviously through the investigation, it was determined that the patients had presented with symptoms sufficient to prescribe the IVs and the treatment that was administered. This complaint was prompted from the mother of the patients, who was in a custody dispute with the father, and that letter was provided to the court, was requested of Dr. Beardsley, and contained information simply regarding logistics of her position, as well as treatment that was provided. And there was nothing false in that letter that was provided to the court, but that ultimately prompted this complaint. At all times, Dr. Beardsley had both written and verbal consent to provide the treatment to the children. She was never informed of any issues or that the mother did not want the children to be treated until December of 2023, when Ms. Graninetti made that request known and Dr. Beardsley stopped treatment of the children. But it was actually a very long-standing relationship, as noted in the investigation. The relationship started as early as 2011. So I'd like to just address a few of the deficiencies that were noted. As far as the allegation that Dr. Beardsley failed to take the patient's temperatures, she did take vitals at all settings. This included heart rate, blood pressure, oxygen saturation. And she did take temperatures on several occasions for both patients. For patient GB, it was documented and taken at one of three visits, and for SB, it was documented and taken at four of five visits. So there were limited instances where Dr. Beardsley deferred to the patients to report other symptoms, and she knew that they were feeling unwell, and she relied on the other vitals, which she felt were more relevant to the treatment that was being administered. As far as the failure to document the peptide combo, it is noted that the patient presented with concerns of fatigue, congestion, and cough. Under the additional plan, Dr. Beardsley documented that the patient dispensed immune support pack supplement, and this was an immune modulating and anti-inflammatory combination that she was using to support overcoming the acute illness, which was well documented in her notes. As far as the failure to provide records prior to 2021, Dr. Beardsley worked at a group practice back in 2011, human performance specialist. That's where she initially met the family. She was only there for 3 months before she left. After she left, it closed. They actually no longer exist. She did not continue treatment of the patient at that time, so there was no continuity of care. She was not the custodian of records for those patients. Ultimately, the father presented a few years later and reestablished care with the patients at Dr. Beardsley's new practice. So she is not able to obtain those records, and nor was she the custodian of those records. We believe that there are some minor issues at most with documentation. However, overall, the documentation was appropriate and met the standard of care. The treatment was appropriate. There was no harm to the patients. Notably, the mother's complaint, even though these patients have been treated for many, many years, didn't come until the issue with the divorce and the custody. So we're requesting that this case be dismissed.
Okay. Before I hear from the complaint, can you assist me on, or perhaps if Dr. Beards is on the line, can you assist me on, can you take in basically with pediatric patients, are you getting a history from maternal, paternal, both? Are you aware when there is a custody battle or divorces, et cetera?
So I'll address this. So as far as intake, yes, on my initial intake, I include all family history. So definitely ask of that with pediatric clients or with just general clients. And then as far as custody battle, that's not something I necessarily inquire about. And in regard to this case particularly, with either SB or GB, I had one parent, if not both, present. No, pardon me. It was one parent at every visit, and I noted that in each note just to verify consent. In fact, the visits were always scheduled by one of the parents per their request. So consent, to my understanding, was present.
Sure. And each visit, as you just stated, had either maternal or paternal after those visits.
Yes.
Okay. And your treatment plan, whether it was perfectly soaked or not, so to speak, was given to either maternal or paternal in terms of how you were going to treat that patient at that time.
Yes. It was all discussed before I provided the treatment. Yes.
Okay. And do you see a lot of pediatric patients?
You know, I see a lot of mothers and then that accompanied by fathers and then children will come. I'm not advertising as a pediatrician. I have four myself, so I'm comfortable with, but I bet you maybe 10% of my client base are pediatric.
Okay. And just for really briefly, what's the emphasis of your practice? What do you primarily do?
Pretty much eclectic primary care. I see a lot. I do a lot of endocrinology with both men, male and female clients, and then general practice.
Okay. And I see the complaint there, but let me run through with my board members really quick until we hear from you, Ms. Giannotti. Dr. Campbell, questions for Dr. Beardsley?
No questions at this time.
Dr. Spatt?
Yeah. Hi, Dr. Beardsley. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thank you for asking.
All right. So I just, enlighten me on the peptide that you inject on pediatric patient that you have. And also, how old is the kid? I try to look in it and I can't find it.
So SB at the time of the use of that injection, pardon me, that was in July 20th of 2023. So she would have been 13, correct? Yeah. So It was a combination of thymus and alpha 1, thymus and beta 4, BPC 157, and glycyrrhizinate. So I use that combination often in acute cases for, you know, acute illness in particular, those that are accompanied by like inflammatory symptoms like body aches, just for relief of symptoms. So I administer a small subcutaneous injection for additional relief beyond the IV therapy.
Okay, so enlighten me on the peptide. Did you have to do blood tests on this individual before you can come up with the correct peptide?
No, it's actually a combination that's already pre-made just for anti-inflammatory and immune modulation. So no, I did not do any additional blood tests. I don't find it necessary as an amino acid sequence. It's nothing that's, you know, pharmacologic or the side effect profiles is quite low, especially with lower doses. So it was just mainly more for an anti-inflammatory.
Okay. So when you give the injection to this this kid, when you who was that? The regarding about the parent, is it the mom or the dad?
Father was present at this visit.
The father was okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. And I assume he weighed up all the side effect and the benefit of the peptide.
Yeah. With everything I administer to every client, including pediatrics, I talk through everything, side effects, possible side effects, and get informed consent.
Okay. All right. All right. That's all I have for a question at the moment, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Spatt. Ms. Gallen?
Nothing to add at this time.
Okay. And Dr. Beersley, my last question to only one, we'll get the complaint now, but do you go through risk, benefit, alternative? Risk, benefit, alternative with all the patients? What's the risk? What's the benefit? What's the alternative type of overview?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. So, Ms. Gannett, can you go ahead and fill us in your perspective?
Are you talking to me?
Yes.
Granted. Yes. So there's a lot to say. I'll try to organize it. Ethan and I divorced over 12 years ago, and Lauren is friends with him, and she knows that we're in a very high conflict. In fact, my ex just tried to go for full custody and child support, and the judge ruled against him in a 7-page court letter. So it's a very high conflict divorce. Lauren knows about that. I did not know about all of the, my children go to, since birth, they've gone to their pediatrician, Papago Buttes. I am a nurse, a NICU and pediatric nurse, RMBSN. So I'm very aware and picky about medical attention for my kids. And they are currently 13 and 16. And so I feel like I'm their voice today. Let's see. So anyway, they've gone to the pediatrician, the same one since they were born. I had no idea this was going on behind my back. I did not know Lauren was treating them. She gave them 8 IVs over the last few years. And it's all out of pocket. I received a bill during court that was $2,305 that Lauren helped populate for father. And again, they are very good friends. She told me she gives him a 50% discount, and the bills indicate way higher than that. And so he tried to sue me for those medical bills. And I explained to the judge that I didn't even know that this was going on behind my back. And the last IV that she gave Sophia is a very gifted girl. She's now 13. She said, "Mom, I don't even know why I got this IV. I only had a cough." And I remember that day that she left, she was extremely well hydrated and she had an excellent appetite. Well, her dad says, "Well, Lauren's halfway over. You're going to get it." My kids don't even want these IVs. There's more to talk about. When we go to the pediatric, it's out of pocket, $20 a sick visit. They can be seen that day. Lauren is not in network and father knows this. And the other concern I have is in her letter, she said that she has given me acupuncture in the past. I've never had acupuncture in my life. She has not given me supplements. She was not ever our primary care physician or provider. My children, again, have always gone to Papago Buttes for their pediatrician. I never would have agreed to any of this. And so, like I said, you know, now the court is deciding on a 2305 bill that is just, it's just ridiculous. And really the whole point of the story is Lauren knows me and she knows me well. She knows that we're divorced and all that. And she never told me that she was treating my kids. She's the mother and it's devastating. I don't want my kids getting all these IVs unless it's extremely necessary for severe dehydration, vomiting, diarrhea, like close to going to the hospital. That's the only time I would ever agree to that. It's devastating because I'm their mother and I didn't even know about this until, he filed in around November. I'm 50% legal decision making and I carry all the medical benefits and I worked very hard to do so. And, you know, I didn't know about any of the prices. My children were being treated or anything. And it really upsets me as a mother. And, you know, I'm a nurse as well. And I just don't think this was done right.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Board member feedback.
If I may have an opportunity to respond to the complainant's comments.
Yes, please.
Thank you. So I think as a result of this complaint, it's transparent that there's disagreement on naturopathic medicine and its efficacy, but at the end of the day, Dr. Beardsley was providing appropriate treatment to the patients with consent. And again, as soon as the disagreement from Ms. Grandinetti was made known to her, she stopped treating the patients, and that was via a text message that was sent to her in December of 2023. And then she's no longer treating the patients based on the complainant's dissatisfaction. But at the end of the day, she met the standard of care and the treatment was indicated, and any issues regarding an interpersonal conflict, the board should decline to exercise any jurisdiction over those.
Thank you, Ms. Shekhar. Dr. Campbell.
Thank you. We appreciate you coming before the board today, Mrs. Grandinetti. And I know that this is a difficult situation all the way around. I guess one of the things that, you know, when we have a separation and, you know, both parents, you know, have, you know, 50-50 custody, typically, you know, when the kids are with one parent, that parent is, you know, of course, responsible for their well-being and making, you know, certain decisions based on severity level and whatnot, you know, and that kind of applies equally to each parent, and the reasonableness of making decisions based on the circumstances at hand, whether they're minor or more severe. And, you know, I'm not sure what the specifics of the court order is and if it outlines anything specific about, their care, for any treatment or whatnot, or if it's a more standard thing at this time. But, you know, the board can't really speak about, you know, bills and who's responsible for what. But on our end, you know, when you have a parent who has, you know, 50% legal custody of their children, the parent, you know, the kids are spending time with that parent, and then that parent goes to a provider, you know, and seeks treatment, especially in a case where, you know, where the treatment, in comparison to, many other treatments, is considered minor. And so that expectation that, you know, well, where's mom or where's dad? You know, we have a huge decision to make here isn't there. You know, then we reflect upon the fact that, you know, that, that the treatment is reasonable. And, you know, it's just, it puts the board in a unique situation from the standpoint of if the standard of care is met and if the physician had permission from a legal guardian to, you know, to accomplish their ends that day, then what else is there for the board to accomplish at that point? I'm not sure if you can understand that or not, if I'm making sense here, but that's kind of like where the board ends up with a situation like this, you know, and so that's all I have to say at this point, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Dr. Campbell, did you feel, as though, and Dr. Spad also, do you feel as though there's a need for better charting, i.e. Met with parents so-and-so, SOAP format, et cetera? Did either one of you have those thoughts?
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Campbell.
Well, I'll actually defer to the physician members on this question.
Oh, okay. So this is Dr. Spad. Yeah, you know, I definitely for charting definitely it could improve, and I would agree with the additional CME in that regard. Regarding about missing temperature or not, that is some of the legal aspect of it that need to be in the chart. So definitely charting could be improved on that aspect. But I just want to ask Ms. Granny Daddy, if possible, how is your daughter now? And when was the last time you saw your daughter, per se?
Oh, can you please ask me that again?
Yeah, how is your daughter now? When was the last time you saw her?
Oh, when did I last time see her?
Yes.
Yesterday.
Oh, okay. And I assume you got here in Arizona?
Yeah, we live here in Arizona, yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. And how is she doing?
She is doing very well. She's a very bright child that wants to be a surgeon someday, a doctor. So, yes, doing very well in school, and she's healthy. It's just my biggest concern was about this is I didn't know about most of it. I would say 99% of all this until November of 2023. I had no idea about most of this unless my children mentioned it to me. And again, I'm a very involved mother. I'm a NICU, pediatric and NICU nurse of 21 years. I'm in the medical field. And so, that's my biggest concern about all of this.
Okay, because I find it, I just not sure what happened, but if you're very close, I'm surprised that you just found out recently that, that your children had been seen by Dr. Beasley. So it's a surprise for me too.
Yeah. So I just found out, well, through the court when he, you know, and I found out in November, he tried to bill me. I don't know, November 22nd, I believe, of 2023. Now, there was a couple of times that one girl had mentioned this and one girl mentioned that after it had happened. But, it, you know, they're teenagers. They don't tell me everything. And it was a big surprise to me when I saw all this through court, through the family court. So.
Okay. Well, you know, one good thing is that, you know, all of your children are doing well. So, that's great. Mm-hmm. So we just try to see what we're going to do with this case per se. But I just want to tell you that since your children are doing well, I'm very happy that everything worked out for your children at the moment.
Thank you very much. I just think between the two of them, they were given at least 8 IVs over these last years, and it's excessive. It's unneeded for a cough. I understand severe dehydration and whatnot, but that's excessive for children. There's side effects that can happen. And thankfully, you know, they are healthy kids right now.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's good. I have a question for Dr. Beasley, please.
Yes.
Yeah, so could you respond to regarding about those 8 IV? What was the circumstance that you gave those IV? Just give me one example or so. Thank you.
Typically, so with those girls in particular, you know, standard hydration, rest, some other, you know, vitamins and nutrients that they were familiar with and had at home weren't really getting them through the illness as quickly as they'd like. So the nutrient IV therapy was just some supplemental support to get their immune systems, you know, just to support them to recover so they get back to, they're you know, athletic and involved in sports and schools and things. So I think they just were wanting to recover, you know, as quickly as possible. So that was why the option was, presented and consented.
Okay. Now, did you wake them at all, before you do the?
I did not wake them.
You didn't wake. Okay.
I did not.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, that's all the question I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Spann. Ms. Gallen, questions?
Not at this time.
Okay. So, you know, Dr. Beardsley, just to avoid these type of, I see both points of view. I see either a mother's point of view. I see your point of view. We don't have the father, obviously, but I'm trying to avoid these type of problems from starting or continuing, not with you and then, you know, anyone else. If you could tighten up those soap notes, obviously risk benefit alternative, maternal present, or paternal present, whatever it happens to be, because those soap notes are really your key to opening the door. So if you would take a course, 8-hour course on basically charting, sure, that could help you avoid, you know, these types of problems and also the confusion it caused with Ms. Granati and future other potential problems down the road.
Yes.
It's critical because, as you well know, those soap notes are your, basically your backup. Because if you see someone 8 months later, you may not have any recollection on who they are, what they came in for, et cetera. So that's, board members, what I'd like to propose is basically like a non-disciplinary order for just 8 hours of charting.
Yeah, this is the first part. I second that. But before I give one, I just want to, Dr. Beasley, also in regarding to IV for children, definitely, you know, I agree with in that, yeah, 8 IV is for me, especially for children, next time I think you should rethink carefully before you do those IV as well.
Okay.
Okay. And Dr. Yeah. If you make for a non-disciplinary order for 8 hours of CME and charting, when does that have to be completed by?
Dr. Beardsley, can you do that within 90 days, do you think?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's go 90 days. Does the board want that to be, that's 8 hours, do you want that to be on top of her 30, or do you want that to be her 30 minus 8 hours?
I would like to see it at the 8 hour additional to the 30.
Okay, so that'll be 38 hours that she'll have for 2024, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so that's the motion. Dr. Spann, sounds like you second.
Okay, and roll call, please. Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Scott?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's move on. It's 2:00. We've been going for 2 hours. Let's go ahead and take a 5-minute recess. And I'll make the motion. Can I get a second?
Second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
May I have a, yes, I'm sorry to interrupt. I have never been to a meeting like this before. I would like to make sure that Lauren Beardsley does not ever treat my daughters again. Can that be, what can we do about that?
I think that's outside of the board's jurisdiction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you'll probably have to bring that up with the judge that's doing your custody work for you.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we'll take a 5-minute recess.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see, we got 202. Gail, do you want to do roll call, see who's back, and if we need a few more moments, we can do that.
Dr. Sadlick, you're here. Dr. Campbell.
Spat is here.
Spat.
I'm here.
Ms. Gallen?
Here.
Oh, okay. We have everybody.
We have everybody. All righty. Let's go ahead. We're going to roll on to the next case, which is Dr. Carol Eastman, case number 24-249. And this is the initial interview. We did discuss this last board meeting, but I'll have Ms. Anthony give us the rundown on that case.
Okay. And Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this matter was discussed and voted on at the February 8th, 2024 board meeting. Where at that point in time, the board voted to administratively suspend the license until such time as Dr. Eastman supplied the required CME for renewal application. However, after the board meeting adjourned, it was determined by discussion with our assistant attorney general that the board in reality did not have the authority to administratively suspend the license. Therefore, we moved forward and opened up an actual complaint and case, and that's what you're seeing before the board today.
All right.
And I'd also like to add, at very late yesterday afternoon, we received additional information from the attorney, and within that information, the last page of that was a certificate of completion of CME for the Southwest Conference on Botanical Medicine. This appears to have been completed March 25th, 2025. And although it is a total of 31.5 hours, it appears that it was only good for 8 hours of pharmacology, and our statute requires 10 hours of pharmacology. So I'd like to point out that that in and of itself doesn't cover the requirements provided in statute.
And when was that CME completed?
According to the certificate, it was completed March 25th of 2024.
Okay, so it was 3 months, if my math's correct, past when she should have had it sent in?
Correct.
Okay. And Dr. Eastman, do you have an attorney present today?
Yes. Hi, Lauren Weinzweig here for Dr. Eastman.
Hi. And can you give us a rundown, Ms. Weinzweig, on Dr. Eastman and the case?
Yeah, and thank you for your time today. I do appreciate it. And I had a little bit of a fear after reading the investigative report that there's some perception that Dr. Eastman is, you know, lied on her renewal application and hasn't completed her CMEs. And I just want to let you know that, you know, the board is, well, some of the board members may be familiar with Dr. Eastman, but she is an honest, she's hardworking physician. She's, you know, caring about her, the well-being of her patients. And I just want to clear up any, you know, misperceptions there might be out there. And I also think that, you know, we wouldn't be here today, but for some misunderstandings about communications with the board, and kind of how those went down in December of 2023 and early 2024. I think, you know, she became frustrated talking, with the info at nd.az.gov account, thinking that she was speaking not with Gail or anybody from the board, but with some auto-generated AI response system. And so I know last meeting there was some discussion about some attitude and some emails that she had, and you know, Dr. Eastman really had no idea that she was speaking to a human being. And as soon as she heard, you know, that the board staff was concerned about or had hurt feelings or, you know, was concerned about her attitude, she called the board the next day, left a message, and then subsequently followed up with a written apology. So just, again, I wanted to put that out there. So Dr. Eastman has a diagnosis of venous insufficiency, which you all know means she can't sit for long periods of time. So last year in 2023, when she sat, well, she purchased the modules for the Southwest Conference on Botanical Medicine and, you know, watched all the modules kind of throughout the year on her own because she just couldn't sit through the live streaming. And it was her understanding, although I'm not really sure this is correct, that if she didn't sit through the live streaming, she wasn't eligible for the certificates. So I do want to talk a little bit about the certificate issue. And one is that I've been in contact with the conference organizers trying to say, hey, can we somehow get these certificates? We did play some phone tag this week, and I spoke to somebody this morning, and she asked me to provide some additional information. So there is that. So maybe we will get the certificates for the 2023 year. But secondly, I would like the board to consider maybe considering alternatives to not having the CME certificates, because she did listen to all the modules and she did, I believe, meet the CME requirements. So the renewal application does have information about that on it. I do note, and this is going to get a little bit legally technical, but I do know that the board statutes and rules require that licensees get 30 hours of CME annually, but they don't specify that in order to, you know, meet the requirement, you also have to show that the certificate, a certificate proving that you attended, let alone that that is the only method of showing that you completed your CME. And as I said, a little bit of legalese here, I bring it up because ARS 41-1030 says that agencies can't make licensing decisions based on requirements and conditions that aren't specifically authorized by statute. So while the statutes and while the rule says you need 30 hours of CME, they don't say, and to prove it, you have to provide a certificate of attendance, and that's the only way you can do it. So I'm hoping that the board is open to having another method of establishing her compliance, maybe through an affidavit or a declaration, or what we'd like to do is maybe get something from the conference. But that's something that we're still kind of in discussions with them about to prove her attendance last year and the completion of the modules, I should say. And then the other thing in the letter that we raised is that there are alternatives that the boards could consider in this particular case, because of, you know, there's extenuating circumstances here involving a misunderstanding of the CME certificate eligibility and Dr. Eastman's diagnosis and illness. Is there a possibility of using the board rule that allows or that requires actually in those situations, the board to grant an extension of 90 days to complete CMEs in, or the complete the CMEs, in which case, Dr. Eastman's attendance at the 2024 conference, should suffice. And I would like to just address, the comment about the pharmacology hours being 8 and the opioid, hours being 3 on that last CME certificate. So I think what in this case happened is that when she completed the, CME attendance form, the program gives you the option of checking for certain programs. Do you want this to apply to your pharmacy hours? Or do you want this to apply to your opioid, and substance or addiction hours? And so she chose addiction hours, even though it could also apply to the pharmacy hours. But in Dr. Eastman's case, she's not one of the NDs licensed in Arizona required to have the opioid hours. So we could go back to the conference and say, look, we'll refill this out so that the hours would be applied towards the pharmacy. So it would actually show us, I think, 11 hours of pharmacy. Just to clarify that she doesn't have a DEA license. She doesn't prescribe any controlled, substances, anything like that. So she's just not subject to, I think it's 32, 4802. That's not part of what she has to do. So I would like to ask for a little bit of leeway on that. So given everything that I've just said, I'm hoping that the board will see, and we're asking that you dismiss this matter, or at least give us a few more time, more days or something to try to get some evidence to fix the CME certificate attendance, or think of alternative ways to establish to your satisfaction that Dr. Eastman did comply with her 2023 CME requirement. And if not, grant, that would be option one. Option two would be allow her under the rule, giving her another 90 days to comply, and then use the 2024 conference CME attendance certificate to assist her with that. Those are my comments at this time. And Dr. Eastman is on the meeting as well, so she can answer your questions. Thank you very much.
So, Ms. Glaswick, just so I understand, because I read the prior, it was last month, why was there such an issue of Dr. Eastman stating to the executive director, Ms. Anthony, that she doesn't release documentation to a regulatory agency? I'm totally perplexed.
So I think that, obviously Carol understands now, at least I think she understands now, because we've had this conversation, that when she was talking to the info at nd.az.gov account, she didn't understand that she was talking to, like, she thought it was some automated AI generated system. It's like when you're, and she was in, she felt like, I think of it as like when you're in that phone loop and you're just like hitting 000 trying to get to the operator. So I think she was concerned that here's a computer system who's just saying, send me this, send me this, send me this. And she just didn't understand. I mean, I just think it was, if she had just understood this, we wouldn't be here. Obviously she would give CME certificates and CME information to the Naturopathic Medical Board. She knows that. But it's just a misunderstanding, and that may come as a surprise to you. But for somebody who's not familiar with how the board operates, and you're getting emails that aren't signed, they're kind of terse and short, and it's maybe not that unreasonable, an understanding, but that's the background, and that's the explanation. And she's available. She can say this too. That's been my understanding.
I have to admit, I am perplexed. Let me ask the other board members. Dr. Campbell, can you give me some feedback, and then I'll move to Dr. Spatt and then Ms. Gallen.
Well, naturally, the board has a high expectation of physicians and their conduct with board staff. If the doctor would like to clear things up, herself, of course, we would welcome that.
Carol, are you there?
Yes, I am. To clarify that, I knew going in that I did not have certificates. And on the form that was filled out or required to be filled out, I didn't see any choice that applied to me. There was nothing that said I don't have certificates. So I picked the one that was the closest. I had taken classes, I paid for the classes, but I couldn't provide certificates, and I wanted to get to the board as quickly as possible and get on with it, make them up, and whatever. So the first comment I got back from info was, just send in the certificates. And I sent another email responding to that saying, well, here's a receipt. I've paid for them to prove that I was not the kind of person that would just blow off continuing education, that I assume, and I had seen previously in a meeting, that one reason people don't have certificates is because they haven't taken the classes. And that was not the case in my case. So I then emailed a receipt to this automated whatever, robot, whatever, that was just saying, send them in. Obviously, if I'd had them, I would have sent them in the first place. And then the response I got back was just, please just send in a copy of the certificates of completion. So now I've been asked twice, and it was frustrating. I wanted to get out of that loop. So I said, and these are all I statements. These are not you statements implying that I'm even talking to someone or that I'm trying to be mean or snarky to someone. And I said, if I had a certificate, I would have attached it in lieu of the list of courses. If I supplied the names of the classes I attended in person or via audio tape and a receipt showing I paid for them, or I saying I supplied, and that I don't share CMEs, I don't pay a colleague half of the cost of the conference and then expect to talk my way out of not getting certificates. I did have a reason. It's the third year I've taken botanical conferences for many, many years, at least 10. And let's see, the last thing I said on there was, it's been your practice to accept them, both hours, with and without certificates of attendance, and that is an error because it should read certificates of attendance from nursing classes. I've taken them from the Nursing Institute, as well as online classes that were meant for MDs. So they weren't classes that were approved by a naturopathic organization. That's what I meant by that. I was getting pretty upset, pretty frustrated.
So I would just, I guess just an answer to Dr. Sadlick's question. It was just, she was just frustrated and in the system. And like I said, it might be difficult for you to understand that because you know how things operate, but that was kind of what she understood.
Okay.
Right. And I wasn't addressing anything to a person. I thought that if I had been talking to a person, people are curious. At least by the second email back from info, if that had been a person, it would have said, okay, so you told me you took the classes, you told me you paid for them, why don't you have certificates?
Yeah,
automated systems can't respond that way.
Sorry. And I think the point here is just that there should have been a phone conversation at some point, and we wouldn't be here, I don't think, today. So in any event, Dr. Sadlick, do you have further questions or any other members of the board?
Yeah, let me, Dr. Campbell, do you have anything more? Because I want to move through Dr. Spatt, Ms. Gell, and I want to go back to Ms. Anthony.
Go ahead and do that.
Okay. Dr. Spatt?
Okay, yeah. Thank you, this is Dr. Spatt. Hi, Dr. Eastman, how are you doing?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
How are you doing?
Well, very flustered. It was not until Sunday night, 4 days ago, that I actually realized that info was Gail.
Okay. Well, I have a few questions I want to ask you. So first, I'm going to reply to your attorney, Lauren. Regarding about the venous insufficiency, you actually can treat it by using, you know, knee-high stocking on it. Okay.
Thigh
and that
high.
Will help. Okay. Yes. And you use the copper one. Okay. All right. So the main concern here is that it's compliant. So apparently, you're not in compliant, and that's the key here. And the other thing is, as you already know, how many units require, apparently you didn't meet the CME, that requirement, but you still say yes on it. I heard what you say earlier. There's no other choice. When you click on the website online, but, it's also have an option that, hey, if you're not complete, then you just say no. So apparently somehow, I don't know where the hiccup at, but, if you didn't, it's actually state right on the website that, hey, if, do I complete, do you have you complete so and so unit? Then you, if you don't, then you just click no or yes. One of those things. So I'm not sure what happened there, but the main concern we have is that apparently you say yes to it, but, you didn't complete. And that's our concern, and it's the compliant issue that we need to address.
If okay. I may address that, I think she did comply. The problem is she can't prove that she complied because she thought she wasn't eligible to get the certificates. So that's why I'm saying we were trying to work with the conference to just this week, because I've only been aware of this a few days, to try to get conference certificates or to ask the board to provide some leeway since the rules themselves don't require conference certificates. That's what I was saying about 41, ARS 41-1030, to make, you know, the obtaining of a conference certificate a requirement for renewal as opposed to the requirement to obtain the CME. So she did do the CME. It's just that we're having trouble providing you with a document that satisfies you. So I just want to make sure that is clear.
Okay. So Gail, you know, I don't make the rule on this. So Gail or Mr. Casey would know more about it on what the leeway on it. But as the board member, I stick with what the bylaw is, and that is to meet the CME that required by our NACHPAT, who practicing as a NACHPAT.
Dr. Spat,
yes.
If I could say something also. I'm looking at the form because I printed it out. The state of Arizona submission form, and I don't see anywhere on here where it says yes or no. Did I miss that on something else?
I'm talking about on the website when you actually renew and so forth. They actually ask you that on the website.
I guess I missed it.
Okay.
I mean, if I checked yes, or I guess I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's very clear on it. But anyway, but that's not the question I have.
Do you check that before you actually get to the form?
You know, Gail could guide you on this.
Because I may have been thinking, having done the classes, I've done half of the requirement. I don't know. I filled this out and applied on December 2nd, which is a Saturday, and quite a while ago.
Dr. Salek, members of the board, the online renewal application mirrors the form application. It asks the licensee if they have, in fact, done the required CME. Have you completed this? Yes or no? That's the simple question it asks.
Okay. But it doesn't say, all right. It just says, have you completed it? Yes. I did complete the form. I can't prove it. And that's, maybe I thought that was a bit ambiguous, because having completed it, but not proving, being able to prove it, I saw as two different things. So I apologize for that. I just looked at it the other way.
Ms. Anthony, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Out of all the licensees that we have, how many had problems with the CME?
So far I have had none. This is the only one that we've had to deal with in terms of board time and my time. There have been times where the CME that they were submitting, and especially for this conference, was not in a certificate format, And I would ask the same question of those folks that I did of Dr. Eastman. Please supply the board with proof you completed the CME in the form of a certificate of completion, which is a typical form that you get when you complete CME. It's nothing new. It's nothing outrageous. Many, many boards request this as a form of, we need to know, did you or did you not complete the CME? And this is the way that we confirm that.
And can you let the board know how many hours of, and I know it's on the website, but just to a refresher, how many hours of opioid training do we have to have?
It's required by legislation that the licensee obtains 3 opioid addiction hours each year.
Okay, and then
the statute, I believe, references, it's not a if you have a DEA number, it's if you can apply for a DEA number, which naturopathic physicians can, they're required to complete these opioid CMEs. And again, this is nothing new. That legislation has been around for quite some time.
Right. It has been. Ms. Gallen, any comments?
Not right now. I'm just listening and taking it in.
Okay. So, I mean, the conclusion to this is we have an issue that the CME wasn't done, or was it done later or not? Was the opioid training done according to state law? So we need to get it straightened up. I have a suggestion. Either we make a motion and suspend her until she does it, or we give her 30 calendar days from today, and everything in terms of the opioid training, in terms of CME, has to be done according to the executive director, submitted properly to her, and that's 30 calendar days from today. Either that or we just move for a suspension.
May I make a comment just before the board makes a motion or makes a vote on a motion?
Yes.
Because I just want to be clear that the statute does say that that only applies, and maybe this is for Mr. Hutchison, but it does say that a health professional who is authorized under this title, so Title 32, to prescribe Schedule II controlled substances, and who has a valid United States DEA registration number, or who's authorized under Chapter 18 of this title, those are pharmacists, to dispense controlled substances, shall complete a minimum of 3 hours of opioid-related, substance use disorder-related, or addiction-related continuing education each license renewal cycle. So I do not believe that that does apply to Carol. She doesn't have a DEA number. She doesn't prescribe Schedule II drugs or any controlled drugs.
Mr. Hutchison, you're just off the cuff opinion.
What statute is that?
3248.02.
She doesn't have a DEA registration number?
Correct.
Then that's off the cuff. That's the way I agree with that reading of the statute.
So that's why I was saying, if you take those numbers for those 3 hours, we can go back to the conference and click on the right button this time, and instead of according those to opioid, hours, just put them into pharmacy and get a new certificate that'll read 11 hours of pharmacy have been done, and I guess a 20.5 of general, I think is what it is. And that's what she completed in March of this year.
Okay, Ms. Wise, we'll hold on for 1 second. Ms. Anthony, what's your thought process?
So in looking at the certificate right now, she's not meeting the requirement. She's short 2 hours in pharmacy. So if it's possible to change those opioid hours to pharmacy hours, then, and if the board agrees that the way the statute reads, in her instance, she doesn't require the opioids, then I would say that she, although late, provided proof that she completed the CME. So then the question becomes, does this March 25th, 2024 certificate apply to 2023? And is she required now, if in fact she renews at the end of the year, is she now required to produce the proof of completion of 2024?
Which she is willing to do another 30 hours for 2024.
So are you saying, Ms. Weiger, are you saying she completed her 30 for 2023?
Yes.
Okay. So just to be clear, so we believe that she completed her 30 hours in 2023 by watching the modules from the 2023 conference. That's the ones that we don't have CME certificates for. The CME certificate that Ms. Anthony's looking at is for the conference she did in 2024. So what we were saying is, can you apply that to 2023? And then she can do another 30 hours for 2024.
And Dr. Salek, members of the board, if I may, Dr. Salek, you brought up a 30-day period to give her time to address this. So if she, in fact, did complete those hours in 2023, I don't understand why she can't get a certificate for completion. And I think that they've discussed that. They're trying to get that certificate. If she can either provide that original certificate that we asked for many months ago for 2023, and then we can apply this 2024 to her renewal at the end of the year. If for some reason within 30 days they can't supply that certificate, and then they need to make sure that this is changed to the 10 pharmacy hours, and we can apply that to 2023, and she'll have to do another required 30 in 2024.
Ms. Wiswick, does that coincide with what your plans are?
Well, that's what we had recommended or suggested to the board as potential solutions. Yes.
Okay. There's the board for all the licensees, it's pretty much the same. There is that discrepancy in terms of the opioids, and that can be figured out. But if there's questions, I would just suggest, Dr. Eastman, that whatever it is, if you need more hours, if you're deficient in any area, that you work very closely with Ms. Anthony to make sure that within 30 days, you have 2023 done. Somehow get a hold of the accrediting agencies, whatever it takes, because otherwise, then you're going to have licensing issues.
I agree. Yes. I think that's the solution that I originally thought would happen.
I'm sorry, actually,
I thought that 2024 would apply, but
yeah, I'm not clear on what the. Well, I know you haven't made a motion, but so you're saying we will try to work with the conference folks, but if we can't get a certificate, you know, because maybe it's too late for them to issue it or for whatever reason, we would like the option to apply the 24 conference hours to 2023. Would that work as well?
I mean, the problem that I see, and it'll be up to the board members and obviously, you know, our executive director, is it's past tense, meaning that it should have been done like everybody else had to do. It should have been done and completed in 2023. So I don't know if that can be applied or not. That would be up to Ms. Anthony, Mr. Hutchinson, and the board.
Right. And that's where we would ask that the board consider using the 90-day extension rule, given the clearly extenuating circumstances and the fact that she was, you know, she did do them. And even though we may not be able to prove it, I mean, we're hoping we can, but if we can't, I'm hoping to have another more creative solution that is certainly allowed under the board's rules.
Ms. Anthony, are you, or Mr. Hutchinson, are you aware of, is that applicable under the board rules?
The board rules do allow a 90-day extension for time to complete the CEs. For any extenuating circumstances, if the board, so in short, I agree with counsel that the board has the power to do that if it feels that's appropriate.
Okay. So board members, further discussion, or do we want to make a motion giving Dr. Eastman 30 calendar days from today to have all paperwork documentation into Ms. Anthony? That would be my motion, but I'm open to suggestions.
Dr. Campbell seconds that motion.
Yeah, this is Dr. Spad. I second that motion for 30 days as well. And after 30 days, if we don't see anything present, then we will suspend Dr. Eastman license.
Ms. Gallen, do you have anything to add?
Not at this time.
Okay.
So, I'm sorry, but may I seek a clarification just so I understand? Would this allow either one of those scenarios where she can either find or somehow obtain the CME certificate for 2020 3 hours, or the board would grant an extension and accept the 2020 4 hours for 2023?
According to, from what I'm gathering from counsel and from our executive director, that would probably be, I don't know how tight that is within the 90-day parameter. I think it would make the 90-day parameter, but would that make the 90-day parameter, Ms. Anthony? Because isn't everything supposed to be in January 1?
Right. So typically that statute or the rule that you're referring to, requesting an extension, typically it has to be provided to the board in writing, requesting an extension, describing why the extension is being requested. And typically that's granted right, you know, before the January 1st deadline. So if that's the case, if it's just for that purpose alone, then we're past that 90-day mark in order to supply that request for an extension due to whatever medical reasons or whatever it may be. But I don't know if Casey has a different interpretation.
The way I read it, that's a mandatory extension if it meets all of those, if it meets what's set out in the rule. But the board has the power, in this forum, for example, even if it wouldn't be mandatory like the rule contemplates, but the board could grant an extension. And then the second thing is that extension of time is to complete the CE. So in this circumstance, if the 2024 CE that we're talking about occurred in March, it's already complete. So if for whatever reason, Dr. Eastman can't prove to the board satisfaction, the 2023 CEs, I don't think that the 90 days would be an issue because the 2024 CEs have already been completed. If the board was willing to accept those under this extension framework.
So would we just make an amendment to the initial motion to say, if we can't get that certificate, then we will accept the 10 hours already completed to satisfy the 2023 mandate of 30 hours, and that the doctor would then be required to start fresh with her 2024 30-hour requirement at that point.
Yeah, that would work, or you could say, and the board is if Dr. Eastman's unable to secure evidence of the attendance at the, or proof of the continuing education for 2023, the board is granting a 90-day extension from January 1st to complete continuing ed, and then the March hours would apply back to the 2023 year.
Mr. Chairman, did you want to just, are you okay with that? Do you want to just approve that as already indicated, and then I'll second?
Yeah, Dr. Campbell, that's fine. I'll approve that as stated, and then we'll need a second, and then we'll need a roll call from Ms. Anthony.
I second.
This took the spot. Before I vote on this, can I make a statement?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So, you know, Dr. Eastman, this is not the first time in regard to renewing your license, you know, the CME have been around for quite a long time. And I feel that, you know, you have dealt with the board before. So I'm just surprised that this happened to you at this time, because you've been a naturopathic physician for years. And so I don't know why this is a hiccup for you. I hope that in the future this wouldn't happen again. And I will vote yes on that motion.
Thank you, Dr. Spatt.
Ms. Gallen?
Yeah, I concur. I agree with what was just said.
That's an aye?
Aye, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, motion carries.
Okay, motion carries 3 days.
Thank you very much, everybody. Appreciate your time and your public service.
Thanks, Ms. Wiswick.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much on my behalf, too, as well.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Board members, we're making decent time. So how about we move on to number 6, I think would next be our agenda. And that would be, review, consideration, and possible action regarding applications. So 6A is, Stacy Cooperman, application for medical license. And this, he or she on the phone. No, Stacy. So let me ask Ms. Anthony to give us a rundown then.
Okay. Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this is an application by endorsement. She has a current California ND license and an expired Utah ND license. Limited scope, no acupuncture. Applicant indicated an affirmative answer on her background questions. Applicant provided the required explanation of conviction indicating an arrest that took place in 2010. For DUI. She attached, the attachment was provided to the board. The applicant summary was provided to the board. Source documents indicate the September 2010 DUI arrest and conviction. Board staff recommends approval of the application.
And I'm sorry, what state was she transferring in from?
She is transferring in from California.
Okay. Do you know if the California board had any issues with her?
They did not. We checked that. We verify those licenses prior to, as a requirement.
Okay. My only concern is that she didn't make the phone call to provide us with any more information in terms of her medical license. But let me run it by the rest of the board members. So she's asking basically, board members, as you well know, she's asking for a medical license here in Arizona.
Were you?
No, my only concern was if you wanted a license and you had an issue that showed up on a prior that you'd probably want to be on the phone, but apparently that didn't work for her. So that was my only issue.
We can always table it till next month if we have questions, of course. I'm not sure. I definitely agree with that. I mean, that's a pretty important issue. I don't know that I have any, I'm not sure if I had any specific questions or not on this one. But yeah, I totally agree.
And then let tailor this case to next month agenda.
Yeah, I mean, her DUI was 2010, but my concern is if you wanted, and Dr. Campbell is, Dr. Spatt, and so is Ms. Gallen, everyone holds licenses in different areas, that you'd at least want to be on the phone to explain if there's any need to. I'll leave it open for the board members to come up with a motion on it.
Well, can I ask this? Gail, do we, when we have an issue like this, how do we present it to the applicant? Do we say that, okay, this is going to go before the board and you have the option to attend, or do we say, and it's highly, you know, recommended that you attend, or how does that go?
Right. And so, I send them a notice of the application is complete because you have a background issue. The board has to review and approve the application before I can issue a license. I don't think we can compel them to attend. I think we can simply ask them to attend. Casey, do you have any input on that?
So what's the question?
Well, should she have, you know, we're just basically wondering why somebody wouldn't appear before the board to answer any questions when they know that the board is going to be reviewing a yes answer to their application. And so we didn't know how that was presented to the applicant, you know, if they have the perception after the interaction with the board that they don't have to attend if they don't want to, and the board is just going to be considering it, and, you know, if it would be reasonable of us to table it, or if we, you know, should move forward based on the facts and leave that out of it.
That's a good question. I think it'd certainly be reasonable, probably gracious of the board to continue it. I don't think there's any requirement, though, so it's really up to the board.
Casey, this is Gail. I'm concerned. I don't know that the board has the ability to require an applicant to attend a board meeting.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think they can be required to. So if they don't want to show, you can't make them. It does, of course, probably not, you know, if it was my application, I think I would make the time, but, yeah.
Yeah, of course, if we were inclined to deny it and we wanted to give the applicant that last one shot to, you know, appeal to the board, you know, but in this particular case, you know, due to the fact that they're transferring in from another state, their experience, there were no issues with the license. It's a issue that comes before the board as a result of a complaint that did not involve their practice. And it's what, 14 years or something ago. I think under normal circumstances, the board has historically approved these applications. So I guess in hindsight, you know, maybe we should just vote on the facts on this particular case.
Yeah, I agree, Dr. Campbell. That's fine.
Okay.
So, Dr. Campbell, do you want to make the motion then?
Sure. I'll make the motion that the board approve this applicant's license to practice in the state of Arizona.
Anyone want to second that?
Go ahead.
And then I guess we'll need roll call from Ms. Anthony.
All right, Dr. Sadlick.
pregnant pause, but I say aye.
Okay. Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
And motion carries.
So we're on to 6B as in boy. This is Thomas Say, application for medical license. And Ms. Anthony, can you give us a review of him?
Mm-hmm. And this is an application by endorsement from California as well. Limited scope, no acupuncture. Applicant indicated one affirmative answer on the background question and provided the required explanation of conviction, indicating an arrest took place in 2011. The applicant provided the supplementation, which was provided to the board. Source documents confirm misdemeanor marijuana violation. Staff recommends approval of the application for license.
And is Thomas on the phone? No Thomas. So I'll let the board members make the motion on this.
Hey, Gail, in 2011, what was the charge on?
What was the charge?
Yeah.
It was a misdemeanor marijuana violation.
Oh, I see. Okay. And on his record in California license, there's no complaint?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to go ahead. I make motion to have him license here as well for Dr. Thomas McSay to be licensed here in the naturopathic as well with limited acupuncture.
Dr. Campbell, second.
Roll call, please. Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Motion carries.
And we're moving on to 6C as in cat. This is for application for medical assistant. This is Frankie Rodriguez. Gail, can you give us just a quick rundown on that?
Her supervising physician is listed on the application as Dr. Brendan McCarthy. Applicant indicated at least one affirmative answer on the applicant's background questions and supplied the supplemental statement. Whereas she states, I was charged with and pled guilty to possession, use, or sale of marijuana, dangerous or narcotic drugs, and possession of stolen property at the age of 18. I have taken care of all my fines and put that part of my life behind me, end quote. Applicant indicated her driver's license was suspended at one point and time due to non-payment of a speeding ticket. Source documents confirm applicant did plead guilty in 2004 to drug possession charge and drug paraphernalia possession charge, both misdemeanors. There was no stolen property charge on the background on the source documents.
Okay. Is Ms. Rodriguez on the phone?
And Dr. Sadler, remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did notice her earlier, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I took it up here.
All right. Any other issues, Ms. Rodriguez, or did pretty much summarize what Ms. Anthony said?
Yeah, what she said.
Okay. So I'll make a motion that, thank you for showing, that we apply her, approve her application for medical assistant.
Thank you.
Dr. Spatt, I second that.
And roll call, please. Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Ms. Rodriguez.
Thank you.
And let's move on to number 7, which would be the executive director report. And we'll go ahead and we'll start with 7A as an apple.
Okay. And Dr. Salek, members of the board, I did send the report. Did anybody have any questions regarding what's on the report?
None for me.
None for me either.
Anything on, so does the board want to take 7A and wrap it through 7G, or do you want to go item by item? Or do you want to look at the executive director report as one, and that would include 7A through 7G? Any questions on any of them? A, B, C, D, et cetera?
None for me.
Okay. None for me either.
None for Dr. Spat. Ms. Gallen?
None for me.
Okay. And any future agenda items that we need to discuss?
Oh, yeah, I'd like to know what happened with that minor surgery that we sent out. Did we get any feedback from any of the naturopathic community? What's going on with that?
And Dr. Spat, we did get feedback, and I've began putting that together. We had anticipated that discussion would be on this agenda, but because of the quorum issues we were having, we pulled that off. And I believe the AZNMA has an alternative sort of proposal on that. And so it's my understanding they will be present at the next meeting to sort of go over that proposal as well. So the discussion will be on the next agenda.
Okay. And then last but not least, in regard to the legislature for the 20 unit CME, are we going anywhere with that?
Yeah.
Any luck with that?
The rules are being processed one at a time, the packets, because it is sort of it's a long process. And so I've just submitted the Article 1s, the certificate to dispense and the medical assistant rules are now in place. They're effective, and the Secretary of State's office is supposed to update those rules by mid-May, I've been told. So hopefully that happens. Those rules have been placed on our website, and I did send out a blanket email to everybody about, hey, these rules are now in place. You can review them on our website. And then I started with Article 1. So Article 1 is going through this process right now. Article 2, and I forget what article that particular CME issue is in, but I'm addressing them one at a time. And this is based on a conversation I had with somebody over at the governor's office suggested we do that, that it would be easier to do it that way. So that's what I've been doing.
Great. Thank you so much. That's all I have.
Okay.
Gail, would you mind adding me to that email list?
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
And that brings us any other future agenda items that board members have now? All right. Let's go ahead and move on to number 9, which is call to the public. And we'll go. Did someone say something? No. So let's do our 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 countdown on that. And then the last thing is number 10. If no one has any other questions, then we're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Good job.
Hey, good to see you, Mr. Casey.
You too.
We appreciate you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye.